I warmly welcome you to the METHOD Festival. The opening words give Vice Rector Helena Rasku-Puttonen. Please, welcome.
Good afternoon, everybody. Distinguished guests, researchers, teaching faculty, and everybody interested in methodological issues and their advancement. Most Finnish universities aim at positioning themselves as internationally renowned research universities among the world's leading universities in their fields. The shared mission is to conduct world-class high-impact research in their fields, in their core fields, particularly those profiled as being at the leading edge, also nationally. In order to achieve that goal, it's critically important to train and recruit world-class experts with advanced methodological skills. Already in 1970s and 1980s, senior researchers and professors in our university realized that managing and analyzing longitudinal data sets can't be accomplished without experts who acquire know-how in sophisticated statistical methods. Longitudinal data and large data in general are demanding for their analyzers. At that time, methods for analyzing quantitative data were not necessarily sensitive or sophisticated enough for the complex designs and questions in human sciences. Now, the situation has improved substantially, and development of methodology has been vibrant. We have sophisticated statistical methods for analyzing quantitative data and advanced statistical packages and effective computers to conduct the analysis. Similarly, continuing development and refinement of qualitative methods provides ways to analyze heterogeneous sets of data. Doctoral students, junior and senior researchers, have a continuous need to maintain and update their methodological skills and understanding at a high level. For the excellence of future research, we should choose our methods in line with our study aims. The key is not whether we know how to use qualitative methods or quantitative methods. Rather, we need to be knowledgeable in both. Mixed method analysis offers us important ways of data analysis, where questions can be looked at from several views. I would like to underline that researchers, whether at their starting phases or already experienced, need support and encouragement for learning, using, and sharing methods. And we all need a forum for discussion on methodology. The yearly Methods Festival offers an excellent opportunity for this. Here, we have top experts in Jyväskylä during these 2 days who are eager to share their expertise in workshops and sessions where we can all learn more about exciting methods. On behalf of the University of Jyväskylä Rectorate, and with great pleasure, I will now open the Methods Festival 2017. You are very welcome to the festival. Please enjoy the days and have inspiring days during being in Jyväskylä. We are enabling excellence for the future in collaboration with University of Tampere and University Technology University of Tampere during these days. You all are warmly welcome.
Thank you for the opening verse, Vice Rector Helena Raskuputtonen. First plenum presentation is given by Lars-Erik Malmberg, who is Associate Professor of Quantitative Methods in Education at the Department of Education, University of Oxford. His current research interests are on intrapersonal approaches to learning processes and modeling of intrapersonal data. You're welcome.
Good morning and welcome everyone. Thank you for the invitation to come here as a speaker. My talk today is on an intravidual approach to educational research and data analysis. I've sectioned the talk into five sections. The slides will also be made available on the shared folder of this festival. So you can have access to those. Maybe they are already up, I'm not sure. Not yet, but they will be. About myself, I'm not actually very far away from my birthplace. I grew up in Vasa and studied there at the Department of Education to be a primary school teacher. And I worked out on the little island of Huchad or Hotskari for some years, after which I returned to the university. Since 2002, I've worked at the Department of Education at the University of Oxford, which is a place I've learned to appreciate very much. You hear the wing beats of history in the street corners and feel that you are standing on the shoulders of some of the giants in our history of science. My two favorite scientists in the city are Thomas Willis, who in the late 1600s opened and dissected both human brains, those of criminals and of cows, to discover how the brain functions. He also termed the Willis circle, which is the central blood flow to the brain, which he discovered. He's of interest for today. He used diary methods for following up his patients, as by tracing people over time through these notes and field notes and diaries, he made discoveries such as migraine and other neurological diseases. They came under different names then. My favorite place is which is now a museum, the Pitts Rivers Museum in Oxford, where Darwin's book launch took place in 1859. He was himself not present at that instance. It caused a lot of commotion in the history of science. Back to intrapersonal research. There's a great growing interest in this type of research in many disciplines, in psychology, educational psychology, and education. The essential ingredient are the multiple repeated measures that people want to collect, and this means if we collect several repeated measures of an individual, we contextualize the experiences of the participants in the study in real time. This means we can minimize the time lag between an event and the report of an event. So we reduce the so-called retrospection bias. methods such as diaries, experience sampling tools, ecological momentary assessment, or contextual activity sampling systems have been developed for capturing such multiple repeated measures. And modern technology, the tablets and apps and mobile phones and Android phones, and you name it, are used as efficient tools for collecting this kind of data. Why do we collect it? Yes, it's in order to understand what students' learning processes look like over time, and also how teachers could support students' learning processes over time. And we need such methods because it's not possible to infer what happens in individuals over time by looking at cross-sectional data. So for really understanding processes, we need process data. An example from educational psychology, which includes processes as a more or less a black box between presage, processes, and products. Processes are seen as the link between kind of inputs and outputs, more or less as a black box. They were operationalized in the studies by Biggs, for example, as trait variables. When I study, I typically do so and so. These were not repeated measures of what happened in particular situations. So if you want to understand what happens in particular situations, we need to ask questions that focus not on what kind of a person the learner is, but what the experience is in such a situation. So here is our examples of so-called trait or self-belief measures that you would find in a questionnaire where you answer questions about what you are like as a learner or a student. And to the right, we have situation-specific measures that correspond broadly to the type of self-beliefs, but these are now located in particular situations. So these can be included in electronic questionnaires for participants to answer numerous times within a relatively short period of time. An example from our Learning Every Lesson study, where we asked primary school students to report on their learning experiences using this already now outdated device called a personal digital assistant. The operative system doesn't work on most laptops anymore, so it's a bit of history by now. So students reported once per learning episode, or at least once per lesson, on their experiences, starting by logging in and then reporting which school subject they were doing. And then also wrote to us about what the contents of the current task were. This was the most time-consuming item in this 19-item questionnaire. Otherwise, the median response time was about 1 minute and 40 seconds, which does not disrupt lessons in classrooms. I'll show you a kind of worked example or an intuition of how students responded to task difficulty and effort beliefs, but here are examples of task difficulty and competence beliefs. So they responded to these three items. For example, task difficulty, the learning task I was doing was from very easy to very hard, and these are items on how well they did it. So what the process is, to get an intuition, what does the process look like once we have collected numerous data points with these questionnaires? So a state is defined as an experience in a situation, and the process is then a sequence of such states or experiences in situations, or could also mean that this is a transformation of one state into the other. Typically, methodology is geared towards understanding states as a process as a sequence of states, not changes from one state to another. But methodologies are emerging also for transitions. So the key questions to ask right now are what does a process look like, how are processes intertwined or coupled with each other over time, and how can we in some way predict processes? So to get an intuition of what a process looks like, we'll look at two example students that I made up. These are Kamal and Sophie. And these are two students have reported on how much effort they have exerted in each situation. And we see that they have the same pattern over time from the first to the 20th occasion. So the effort profiles are the same. It is very rare to find two students who would actually report the same profile. But here we see that the even though the process says look the same for effort exertion, they are responding with their effort to different kind of challenges in their context. So the difficulty profile that Kamal reports on looks different from the difficulty profile that Sophie reports on. So they interpret challenges in situations differently and exert effort, even though they exert effort the same way. And what we see is that Kamal exerts high effort when tasks get more difficult than usual, and Sophie, she withdraws effort when the tasks get slightly more difficult than usual. So these are two different patterns. If we rearrange the observations so that we now turn those into to scatter plots between effort and difficulty, so we get rid of the time axis in a way, and we include a correlation coefficient. So here we see that when things get more difficult for Kamal, he exerts more effort, and when things get more difficult for Sophie, she withdraws from that effort. So now we have seen that these two processes of effort exertion and perceived task difficulty operate differently for different children, and these are possible to find. However, the processes look more complex. Here are intertwined processes of competence evaluation in blue lines across time and effort exertion in black lines, and then task difficulty in green lines over time. We see that there's about a quarter of the variance between students, and the rest of the variance is variance across the time points. So there's a lot of events that take place. There are a lot more variation between than within. More variation within than between persons, and the patterns look remarkably different. Some experience more variation from one situation to the other, and different reactions to different challenges. So, how do we model all this? If we start with the correlation coefficient again between effort and the task difficulty, we now calculate a correlation coefficient for each student, and we plot the correlation coefficients here in this graph. So this is a low correlation, a negative correlation, which means that the more difficult the task, the less effort is exerted, and these students' correlation coefficients are positive, meaning that the more difficult the task, the more effort is exerted. So we can descriptively look at the correlation coefficients, and they have a quite nice distribution there. If we turn this into a regression model, and here represent each student as one line in this scattergram of regression lines, we see that some of those lines are go point upwards, have an upward slope, meaning more difficulty results in more effort, and for some students the slope is negative, so that's more difficulty, less effort. But then we have the kind of quite even lines as well. So there's a mixture of regression lines in this scattergram. We can model these, and then we can also try to see if we can predict which way that regression slope will go, and we did so by including student achievement into the model, and we found that higher performers are confronted with more challenging tasks, they then exert more effort, and when low achievers are confronted with these challenging tasks, they exert less effort. And this is a pattern that has been predicted in cross-sectional studies, and so we now were able to replicate these findings, but also in the intrapersonal study. What other kinds of processes have researchers investigated? Here are some snapshots from the literature, which is rapidly expanding the number of keywords on intra-individual and process and intrapersonal analysis is growing year on year, and people have investigated since Schmitzer-Skinner's seminal article in 1993. Then there was 20 years of silence, approximately, and now there's a big upsurge in studies of academic emotions, coping with boredom, metacognitive strategies, engagement, task difficulty, effort, and competence beliefs, and also among teachers, emotions, and mastery experiences from one teaching session to another. So there are plenty of topics, and this is not a complete list. How do we analyze the data? If we go back to the idea of Cattell's, where we need to discriminate between variables, persons, and occasions, we see that with the intrapersonal approach, we clearly have plenty of occasions in our models. And the question and the critique against this cube model is that where is context hiding in this cube? And one way to think of it, as these are also occasional time points, students' perceptions of what is going on in the lessons, such as we saw with the example of difficulty. And in the next study, I suggest we used students' perception of controlled motivation, that is the teacher's expectations in each learning situation over time. And then we can model those with the multi-level model, where we partition the variance in the models into a within and between person part. We can also include within and between level predictors in this model. We search for moderators or cross-level interactions. That was the example I gave with student achievement level as a predictor of those regression slopes. And that means we can find between person characteristics that can explain this moderation. Many of the models that we will see does not include time as an explicit modeled predictor in the model. That is, many researchers approach the analysis as individuals as their own controls, seeing how individuals exert effort when the situation is more or less challenging than their average situation. We also see example of researchers who model time as a fixed effect included in the models. For example, what time of day is it, or what day of the week is it, or model these as different levels in the multi-level model. So we included educational context into the process model by asking students about their controlled motivation in each learning situation. And this goes beyond the interpersonal studies in motivation that have been carried out broadly by Ryan and DC. And we also go beyond the Rattel et al. Paper, where they used the person approach to identify different profiles. And they asked the question, are students switching between two types of motivation at different times? And, well, with intrapersonal data, we can actually answer that research question, or the question that they posed in their paper. So we posed two research questions: the teacher demands and expectations, that is the controlled motivation, predict autonomous motivation within and between students. And I use autonomous and controlled motivation synonymously with extrinsic and intrinsic motivation that are also used broadly in the field. So does controlled motivation differentially predict autonomous motivation? And I will show what this looks like. In the PDA questionnaire, students responded to 5 items about their motivation. So autonomous motivation was measured by students enjoying their task, choosing to do it, and their being interested in it, and controlled motivation by them having to do it, or the teacher wanted them to do it. So these are the teacher expectations in that situation. Had 314 students, responded on average 11.2 experiences each. We average the teacher reports of the students' performance. So these are the students' grades in mathematics, English, and science. And in England, these are absolute judgments of how well students have learned what is covered in the curriculum, so not necessarily grading on a curve, but in absolute terms. Task focus, there we use the Nurmi and Aunola's measure on students' task-related behavior and work habits. So students coded positively, so that students, for example, actively attempt to solve even difficult tasks. These are one-off judgments by the teacher, so these are not situation-specific reports, but we use this as a person characteristics of the students. So we applied the multi-level structural equation model. It enables us to specify both simple and complex multivariate models that are not possible to specify in a multiple regression framework. It enables us to investigate the structural validity of latent constructs, and at the same time, as we investigate relationships between the latent constructs, and we obtain parameter estimates like the beta coefficients and R squares, explained variances, and these are all net of the measurement error that we model separately in the model. So if we take a deep breath and fasten our seat belts, I think the model is coming up here on the next slide. So I'll just talk you through how to read this graph. So here are the observed variables. Here are the manifest. So three marks in the three school subjects. And then we have two items measuring controlled motivation, three items measuring autonomous motivation. And then we have teacher-reported task focus, three positively worded items, and three negatively worded items. Then, in order to model this in two levels, there is a set of circles here and a set of circles here depicting latent constructs. These are variables that are not directly observed in the data set, but these are constructed in the modeling process. So what happens is that the variance-covariance matrix is partitioned into two parts. One is partitioned into the between-level variance-covariance matrix, and those circles represent how that information is modeled. And here we have the within-part variance-covariance matrix that is then modeled separately. So this means we can partition the results, so we have separate results at the within and between level. So these are the time points within students, and these are the differences between the students. Then we have a second set of circles here that are also denote unobserved variables. These are the uniquenesses. This is or also called the measurement error. So this is where the noise in the model goes. And when we have all the noise captured by these uniquenesses, there's one uniqueness per item, then all the parameter estimates that we're interested in the next steps, but these would be the variances, the associations between all the latent constructs. These are going to be net or disattenuated for the measurement error that we have in no noisy data. So, and in addition to that, task focus includes a method factor for negative wording, which makes the data the model fit data better, as Nurmi and colleagues have previously demonstrated. So this is quite a big model, the model fitted data well. And if we then switch focus, so we only look at the structural part of the model. This is the part where we look at the parameter estimates or the regression paths of our interest that answer the research question. So at the within level, we find that controlled motivation predicts autonomous motivation. So the higher the teacher expectations, students are also more intrinsically motivated. They enjoy and are interested and choose the tasks to a higher extent. At the between level, this prediction also holds, And then in addition, we found that the higher the student's performance, they're also perceived teachers as having higher expectations on them, which in turn predicts that they enjoy and choose and are interested in their tasks more, and that in then turn predicts a higher task focus. That means teachers report that students are on task rather than off task. And there's also a direct path from performance to task focus. But none of these relationships were statistically significant. In the next step of the model is the relationship between control and autonomous motivation across the time points. Might this vary across the different students? So what we then did was to allow this relationship to as a random factor. That means we're going to include it up here in the model. What this says is that allow all those regression slopes to be different between the students, and I'll show you what it looks like in the next slide. That was significantly predicted by performance again, and what this looks like is when we plot the cross-level interaction effect. Is the microphone okay? So what we saw is that if we split the data into three type of, we plot the data for students of different academic performance levels, so high achievers, when their controlled motivation goes up, that means teachers set higher demands and expectations on them, their autonomous motivation seems to go down slightly, but not completely derailed, because that's still at a high level. For low achievers, the more expectations teachers have of them, their enjoyment is also higher in those situations. So we found this interesting moderation effect. And how we could discuss what this means really is that the higher achievers were not completely derailed by teacher expectations. I mean, it did sink dramatically. Lower achievers were motivated by the teacher expectations. This could, we don't know if this poses a risk, if this is a short-term engagement because of the teacher expectations, and if those fade away again the following lesson, then that might mean it's a short-lived motivation. So the question is, how can that controlled or extrinsic motivation become integrated into the self? And we know from the literature that these external demands can be facilitated or integrated into the self through emotional autonomy and instructional support by the teacher. These are variables we didn't have in our study, but I think this would be a fruitful next step of investigations. What is it that really drives internalizing the extrinsic demands so that students motivate themselves? There are many implications and challenges for teachers in classrooms based on these results. One is that teachers need to recognize the highs and lows of each student. Lower performers do have their good moments when they are very switched on, and also high achievers can get derailed. And recognize in which situations these highs and lows can occur. This is what teachers do in their everyday job, but it is not clear to what extent there is an awareness of these processes that go on. The kind of implications for pedagogy are clear, that one size of teaching does not fit all students, but the situational specific situation-specific interventions seems to be what is driving that learning. More investigations are needed on this topic. So where do we go from here? In our study, we did control for between classroom differences, but we did not model those. We found an intra-class correlation of 0.10. for autonomous motivation between 23 teachers. So that means that students are differently intrinsically motivated or autonomously motivated, depending on which teacher they are with. So there does appear to be some differences between teachers already with 23. However, in order to draw broader conclusions about how teachers differ in the way they can motivate students, we would need larger samples where we have more classrooms included. And this poses a challenge to the interpersonal designs, where the data collection is very time-consuming. Other future steps can be links with observations of observed quality. Also here, the number of classrooms might remain low, but the situations across time, there's work going on by Pösa and colleagues here at the University of Jyväskylä in that direction. And another promising route is to investigate whether students differ in their motivation with different teachers. And this can be investigated with a so-called cross-classified data structure, where the time points of the situations of the students, they're nested in both, the reports are nested both in students and at teachers at the same time. And our first attempts in this direction do show that even with the very few teachers that we have, there are even significant differences between the teachers when students are taught by two or more teachers. Other interesting ways forward would be to have teacher ratings of their interaction with students in each situation. So a method of using target students. Teachers anecdotally in England say that they could report on four students or maybe six students each lesson. And that could be an interesting study design, I think. And we can also have student ratings of the teacher each learning episode to match teacher ratings. This could enable us to investigate to what extent teachers differentiate between student groups and also between teachers differ in the way they can treat different students. The next step is to think of how we conceptualize time in modeling. In the models that I've presented up to now, time was not included as an explicit predictor in these models. Time was, individuals were used as their own controls. And this means that time was implicitly conceptualized as discrete chronologically. In the next steps, we could then discriminate between two ways of analyzing the data. The first is that the time is regarded discrete, chronologically ordered, and equidistant time points from the first to the nth time point. Or then we could consider that time is continuous, so that we have time gaps that are different across participants. For example, we have here three consecutive days, then a jump over a weekend, and then we continue after the weekend. Then we have different time stamps, and the distances between those reports are not equidistant. So the next step I will show you is to see how we, in the next steps, model time as discrete time steps. So that we just have a number of time steps and we assume equidistant time points. And this is to organize the data into kind of time series type analysis or so-called lagged data. So the way we treat the data before we run the models is we then have each individual and then we have the time points nested in the individuals and then we have variable A and variable B. And then when we lag the variable, means that we take this set of observations and we lag them one step. So we have the previous time point, one step earlier, t minus one, as a predictor of the concurrent time point. So those values of the time point one are going to predict what happens at time point two. So this is the way data was prearranged into the next step of modeling. And then in the following step, it is possible also to adjust for how far apart those observations are in time. So the multi-level dynamic factor analysis with lagged time point data included within the within part of the model are now interested in, for example, how intrinsic or autonomous motivation at time t minus 1 predicts intrinsic motivation at time t. And then at the between level, we model how different those students are between each other in their intrinsic motivation during that calendar week. So preliminary work in this direction, when we look at some of the variables in our study, we find that the controlled motivation, this seems to be very stable from one time point to another. The coefficient is red, so the higher values means that things are stable over time. So the higher in time point t minus 1, the higher the value will also be at time point t. We see that autonomous motivation is also stronger, the next highest association there. And then we have competence beliefs, how well they succeed and how much they understand. Slightly less stable, but still on the positive side. The effort seems to come and go much more. So that seems to be relatively instable across time. And task difficulty is not statistically significant. That means there, this is the variable in which the largest fluctuations occur over time. So the context that the teachers create seem to create a very stable environment, but the tasks that the students do from one school subject to another over time, that seems to be very unstable over time. The other interesting thing to then look at is the so-called cross lags. So what happens if something that happens in a previous learning situation, a previous lesson, influences what happens in the subsequent lesson? And what we can see here, in addition to the cross lag, time lags, autoregressive lags, we then have the cross lags. So the more competent the students felt at the previous time point, the less difficult he or she finds it in the subsequent, at the subsequent time point. The more effort that was exerted at the previous time point, the more difficult they found it in the concurrent time point. I'm still thinking of what this result might mean. One explanation could be that the more effort that is exerted, the more the ego is depleted. Effort is a finite resource that we have. So if you use up your energy in the previous lesson, there isn't so much more in the subsequent lesson, and hence tasks could appear as more difficult. More research is needed for investigating that link. There could also be strong individual differences in that path, which is the next step I want to look at. Controlled motivation, the context that the teacher creates at the previous time point, that predicts a higher level of autonomous motivation in the subsequent lesson. And this, to me, emphasizes the ways in which teachers can create stable learning environments. We can also, we here looked up to now at the stability across time. Another subject to look at is the variability. We have seen that there are large fluctuations across time for some students, and in order to get a measure of how large those fluctuations are, we can use an entity called the mean squared sequential difference, which means that we see how much the oscillations are and how large the fluctuations are and compare those across individuals. And we specified a multi-level structural equation model in which we modeled three constructs, a trait construct, so differences between students in their weekly average of the particular variable, and the variability is how large are the fluctuations in that variable across the week. And then we have the states, the within part of the model. Those are the situation-specific measures. The findings are interesting, and indeed, the trait construct and the variability construct do pick up different conceptual entities, as the trait construct, when associated with task focus, So more task-focused students found it generally less difficult across the week. More task-focused students felt more competent and more intrinsically motivated. The more task-focused students were, the less variable they were in their perceived difficulty across time. The more task-focused, the less variable they were in their competence beliefs across the week, but it did not have a significant effect on the intrinsic motivation. So the dynamic factor analysis, that is using models that are suitable for this lagged data, is promising, but it does assume equidistant time points. And in data, we know that the time points between the measurements can differ, and individuals can have different number of observations and different number of lags, different lengths of those lags between the time points. And then the question arises, how do we model downtime, for example, when students sleep in the afternoons, in the evenings, and how do we model weekends into these models? There are some promising software developments which can take these factors into account, which I'm learning at present. The first one is the continuous time structural equation modeling package in R, which is freely available by Manuel Folkle and colleagues, and M plus version 8, which is coming out, I think, now in the summer, which should enable models of both discrete time and continuous time. So we're looking very much forward to seeing what the package includes. So just to give an intuition again of what the difference between discrete and continuous time is, here we have Kamal's discrete time observations of effort, and we see that up after the sixth time point, which happens to be the end of the day, here we see that if we include the exact time points as which he has responded, we see that the lags do, in fact, look different. And then we have downtime between 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 9 the next morning. So that's 9 plus 9, it's 18 hours of time. 18 hours in between. So these are interesting challenges for intrapersonal modelers to deal with. To wrap up on future research designs, future study designs to go broaden the field could include studies where we have an intervention component. We know from diary studies that those who keep a diary of some sort enhance their self-monitoring over time, and just by enhancing self-monitoring means that you might be likely to change your behavior. We also have anecdotal evidence from teachers that suggests that the more they think of how successful they were in promoting students' higher order thinking, the more they started thinking, remembering that every time they stepped into the classroom and said, now I have to promote the higher order thinking of the students in this group. So our questionnaire actually functioned as a prompt as an intervention prompt at the same time. So this could be an important future avenue to use these devices and figure out a way in which we could have one as an intervention condition with multiple self-reports, another in a control condition for multiple self-reports. So the prompts are interesting. Other designs are so-called ABAB, burst designs, where we have sequences of intensive measurement, intervention or development or business as usual, and then another intensive measurement, and then an intervention. And they're interesting methodologies for dealing with these scenarios in the making. Another design, which I already mentioned, is the kind of teachers using target students to report on the interaction with each situation. And then finally, we could also think of incorporating biophysiological measures and using different timescales for stress levels, activity levels, or sleep. And then we would have continuous time nested in subjective time. Those are the self-reports. So continuous time in self-reported experiences of time, and then differences between students. And this poses an interesting methodological adventure as well. To wrap up, interpersonal research in education can, firstly, bring theorizing about learning and teaching processes more aligned with empirical studies of these. So for really theorizing about processes, we should also have process data to back that up. It enables insight into to differences in students' learning and their processes over time. And finally, and most importantly, it suggests that the one-size-fits-all teaching strategy for all students in a group does not necessarily fit well. So in England, there is an initiative, policy initiative called personalized learning. And I think that our findings are in support of this kind of teaching methodology. Thank you so much for your interest. And I think there is still time for some questions, if I've kept my time well.
Thank you for your interesting presentation. Now we have time, 15 minutes, to discuss and ask questions. Please, there is two microphones you can use.
I think there's a question here.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. I was wondering about whether you've noticed measurement or effects of the measurement on your data when you start the measurement and people start using the devices, because I've heard that some research groups, they noticed that okay, people answer completely differently in the beginning of the measurement period, and then they just discard the first data that people put in, and some people try to model it. So what's your take on this?
That's an interesting idea. Let me go back to some of the screenshots we have of these 9 example students. We have thought of this, and the question is, really, it's difficult to say. If we, for example, here is a student who reports continuous high effort, and then there's only one peak of task difficulty, really, and then there's plateau again. And also the competence evaluation just takes a dip during that one task, and then there's a plateau again. I think this is the scenario you refer to. We haven't tried to model this particularly in our data, but it is something to be aware of. It will be interesting to hear more about strategies researchers have used for trying to model it. What's the difference of the first 10 sessions as compared to the next 10 sessions? What we have done is that if we model the change over time as a kind of growth model with all the available time points, then there is very little absolute increase or decrease over the 1 week period, and this suggests that an kind of intercept variance model seems to fit data better than a change over time model. But I think it's an important issue in this type of research. More questions, queries?
Question.
There's one coming up.
There is one question.
One over here. I think there's a question over here.
Have you ever showed some of the results to individual students? And if you have they learned something about their learning processes in order to make them even better learners for the future?
Yep. Good question. When we piloted the study, we did talk about students and with very open-ended discussions with them afterwards, asked about their feelings, but we haven't fed back individual results to students. But we did do that with the teachers in a study, who they completed questionnaires over a two-week period, and we then plotted both their emotions over the two-week period and their mastery experiences of teaching over the period. And I don't know if they then became better teachers, but it was in one of these interviews that they said that it really made them focus on the questions that we were going to ask. So that we do know that it's responding to questionnaires repeatedly can serve as an intervention prompt that we did learn. And I'm sure this could happen well with students as well. It is on the agenda and of things to do, I think.
More questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For your interest.